Okay, we will call the meeting of the Ag Rural Economies Veterans Affairs Finance Committee to order. Representative Magnus moves the minutes of March 10th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Members, we're going to change the order a little bit. Apparently, we got the high school pages here, and what we're doing is really boring, except for the Olin bill on wolves or something. So we're going to do something that might be interesting to them first. And plus, Representative Olin isn't on this committee, so we can get him on his way. So if you want to come up, is he here? Where is he?
I'm right back.
Oh, there he is. All right, come on up and tell us about wolves. I'll move House File 3262 before the committee for activity here. When we're done working on it today, we will lay it over for possible inclusion next week in a larger bill. I think it doesn't go anywhere, right? All right. And then you have a DE1 you want put on?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I'll move the DE1 to get the bill in the order that the author wants it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That's adopted. The bill is before us as shown in the DE1. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, this is a relatively short, quick bill now that we've had a couple discussions behind the scenes on a misunderstanding on some words. But in essence, all this bill does is allow for an additional person or persons to be added as people that can investigate wolf compensation claims. Because in some areas, what happens when you have only the United States Department of Agriculture people or DNR, they're just not on duty on a timely basis that's required by the law to investigate a claim. So this would allow the sheriff's office to be added as a third party, and that's basically what the bill does. Bruce Clevens here, because Bruce actually did the negotiations for me behind the scenes, because I was unable to get to the meeting at 11 o'clock one morning because of other conflicts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce Clayman, I represent Minnesota State Cattlemen. Representative Olin has laid out the bill and what the purpose behind it was. This is a Peace in the Valley amendment. There is zero fiscal cost on this for your committee, Mr. Chair. I can take you through the DE quickly. Line 1.10, fair market value, we strike conservation officer on 1.11 simply because they're not really in a position to determine what the value of cattle would be necessarily. The guts of the bill run from 1.16 to 1.19. In the previous practice, it was either extension agent or the conservation officer, and as Representative indicated, they're not always available, whereas the sheriff can be dispatched 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and come by and see the remains, and that was the whole point. We also add animal plant and inspection service. That's a guy out of Grand Rapids who also has approval authority on these kind of investigations, so
before
we put him in there.
Before we go forward any further, yep. I think it's interesting that we're adding the USDA person. You've visited with them. They're all right. I mean, we really have no oversight on them. Adding them is okay, but doesn't mean they'll necessarily have to do anything we tell them.
You are correct, Mr. Chairman. All right. They don't have to do anything. They're available, and they have approval authority.
But as far as our reimbursement for damage or whatnot, we can accept their report. That's what
right.
It's saying here.
That's right. And then we move on the investigator on line 1.20 because we have different people. We just capture that with the word investigator. And then the remaining strikeouts have to do with efficiency and best management practices, which really didn't make any difference to anybody anywhere, so we took them out. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill.
Well, and to make it more interesting for the pages, but mainly for me, just walk us through a situation that might happen up in Representative Olin's district. And what happens? Why would you call someone? What takes place very shortly, and then what kind of reimbursement and who pays it at the end? Because all this is related to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll give you the prime example I can think of, but I won't name the individual, although I'm sure you wouldn't care if I used his name. He's appeared down here in other issues. What happens in my district, or in a lot of, in other areas of the state too, but I can give you the example that happened in my district, is that the conservation officers only work a regular Monday through Friday hours, and if you've got a wolf damage of cattle somewhere over the weekend, you couldn't necessarily hit the time frame necessary by the rules and regulations.
Now again, even get more specific. Give us the example. What kind of wolf damage to cattle? Would they bite their ear off, or do they?
No, wolf damage to cattle. I was going to get to that, but the wolf damage to cattle completely kills calves, and they kill considerable calves. And then you can't, if they don't get out to investigate immediately, you can't figure out why or what happened to them on a timely basis, and they won't pay a claim because it's not time. But they completely kill the calves, and usually you can find enough of the calf remains, certain parts of it that'll still be there, that even though they may have eaten a lot of it, there's something there, so they have something to base it on if you respond quick. Couldn't make the claims, but the sheriff's office, and this happened basically in Kitson County, the example I'm using, said, well, we could handle that situation. So then behind the scenes, I talked to the extension officer and the Cattlemen's Association, and we came up with a plan where the sheriff's office could be added in those situations where the response wasn't quick enough. And that's...
So what happens now? So now they're out there.
Okay. They're out there now.
All the way to the end.
Yeah. All right. They'll investigate the what happened, and usually what that consists of is you can see the calf's remains, whatever's left. You can take pictures, etc., to show, and you can usually see wolf prints or something right in the general area too. So you know that it's what happened to the animal. So you can make the evaluation that. Investigation report based on what you actually see at the scenes, and hopefully in some cases to avoid any necessary problems, they'll take some pictures of the scene just so those are on record too. So, but they'll do a thorough investigation, and when their investigation is done, then they'll have to go home, as the deputies always do on any kind of police response that they make, and they'll have to then put out do a police report just like it was a regular police matter, only this is an investigation on a death of a wolf kill caused, and then that report would be forwarded on to the extension agent in the area, which is the guy that I talk directly to, and he lives right in the Hallock area, but he's not a 24-hour employee either, so really, the only person that's a 24-hour employee that can respond as quick as the rules require is a deputy, because they're always on call.
And I guess now, and whether you know or maybe Mr. Clavin, why are we going through the extension service? Why isn't it directly? I mean, who's paying the claim?
Okay.
DNR or agriculture, and why? Or is the U of M paying?
Okay. Now, Andrew, to make it clear, I'm not going
who's
in.
Who's paying the claim, and how we got to that point?
Okay. The claim is actually being paid by the out of the Department of Ag funds on a bill that I actually handled the last 2-4 years to set out claims for people who were actually injured by animals, and this particular part we're dealing with is the wolf. Now that same bill would also handle elk situation funding too, but we're not going to get into that part of it because this isn't what we're doing on this bill. But the bill puts forth a pot of money at the state level so that you can actually, if you have damage done, that you can apply for relief from the state. And once they apply for, then they can get that relief if they can prove that it was actually a wolf situation, and that's why you need to do this investigation at the beginning,
right
up front. Because if you don't do it up front, all you're going to have is, I had this happen. Well, unfortunately.
What do they get, fair market value for the calf?
I mean, they get fair market value, and we did put those specific words in here for a calf.
Right. So we get it. The Department of Ag pays, but again, I want to know specifically why are we going through the extension service when we have ag agents out there that do chemical inspections and other things? Why are we going through the University of Minnesota?
Why are we going through the University of Minnesota and extension? Because the University of Minnesota is a extension. This particular part is also connected with the Department of Agriculture, the State Department of Agriculture, who oversees this program.
Does the extension charge us any money?
No, not
for that service.
Not that I'm aware of. It's already an extension.
I mean, this committee, Representative Olin, and others are trying to get rid of these layers of government.
Yep.
So now we've got the local sheriff, and now we go to the University of Minnesota, and now we're going to go over to the Department of Agriculture. I mean, we're bouncing around. Eventually, everyone's going to want some money for this somewhere along the line.
For years, we've been doing this basic procedure, and it's never been a problem except wolf damage is a too short term a situation that you have to be able to investigate on.
All right. Any questions on wolves or wolf damage? I think we're probably fully informed now. So, members, what we'll do is we're going to vote on this. We did vote to put the bill in the order. Now we'll just lay it over for possible inclusion in a larger bill next week, a finance and policy bill that's coming out next week before deadline. So, Representative Anderson, you almost snuck away.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, just out of curiosity, can a sheriff's deputy, how do you tell if it's a wolf or a bear or a cougar or a bobcat? How do they determine the culprit?
Or does it matter? If any of our wild animals in Minnesota kill a calf, are we responsible for reimbursement?
Well, in answer to the compensation question, in reality, the state has got this pot of money that could be used in something other than just the wolf situation. This pot of money is not limited to wolves. We're dealing with wolves today. But the bill that was passed in this legislature and has existed for years was increased to cover depredation caused by any kind of animal to farmers anywhere in the state. So it's not just wolves.
Then to Representative Anderson's question, is it really easy to tell wolves? I mean, what if you have a pack of dogs out there? Domestic dogs, basically, that, you know, the neighbor dogs have gotten together, and we've seen that in our neighborhood where you'll see a pack of dogs come through. Do they get paid for damage on those? Or how would you tell the difference?
How would you tell the difference? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically, you tell the difference basically by what's happening in that general area. You'd have to ask the farmer that actually had the damage done to him if there's any calf. And then just about anybody in a farm area is going to be able to tell you if there's any wild pack of animals, dogs running through, or if there's a wolf, a bear in the area, or whatever else. They know specifically what animal it is.
Okay. And it's all right. Any other questions? Seeing none.
One last comment.
Yes, sir.
Just to make sure that everybody understands, there's not one dime of extra money being added. It's the same amount of money from the previous bill, but that was voted on last year, to be exact, but it's been on the books for years, just the amounts were increased last year.
Mr. Clavin or the department or anyone else, do we have enough money in that pot? Too much? Not enough?
Mr. Chairman, I think the pot runs dry every year, and it also includes crop damage.
But it goes fiscal year to fiscal year, so if it runs dry in the next few months, it's re-upped in July 1st for the next.
I think it's always run shorter. I think there always isn't enough to take.
Well, we'll get a report on that, I suppose, next year when we do our larger budget bill again. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Representative Olin. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
As Representative Faust is coming to get ready, members, here's our schedule. What we're going to do is not have a meeting tomorrow. I'm sure that breaks everyone's heart, but we will not meet tomorrow, so you've got an extra hour and a half to do whatever you want. I'm going to be meeting with our staff and with the lead and vice chair of this committee and their staff. We're going to go over all the bills that have been passed or will be passed or considered being passed in this committee and Representative Tremba's committee and Representative Conan's committee. And we'll assemble a large omnibus bill next week. Hopefully we can get it written by Tuesday, give staff enough time to do that. We'll introduce the bill on Tuesday of next week. We'll mark it up on Wednesday. I expect very little markup, but you know, we'll give people an opportunity to look at it. But again, I'm going to be working with both of our minority members here at Leeds, and I would think, you know, most of these are bills have already passed. Some of them, like we're going to hear today, have pieces that, you know, might be controversial that we'll have to make some decisions on as a committee. But so that's kind of our schedule. That'll get us done then. Monday is the deadline for that second committee. before we go home to Easter break, and we don't meet Monday, and we won't have to meet Monday then, obviously. So just for your planning purposes. Representative Faust, again, we're going to move, what do we got here? House file 3295, before the committee for possible inclusion in that bill that we're talking about next week. So we'll go through it. Members, as they go through it, certainly ask questions. I'm going to, as they go through separate sections of this. This is a department bill, I believe. But Representative Faust, you can introduce it and then hand it off to whoever you want.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you're absolutely right. This is a department bill, and so you can say no more about it than I do, and I don't want to confuse anyone. I'll just turn it over to them. So thank you.
Welcome. Who's ever going to be the spokesperson here? Introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Greg Tzicki. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I will address the first three sections. These are pesticide-related provisions. This is a...
Hang on 1 minute. Representative Otremba. You want to say something about you're introducing someone, I believe, before we get any further. Otherwise, I won't interrupt you, Mr. Bezicki. But
there's Joe is here. He's actually shadowing me this year, so he's great.
Okay. He's with MEALSI.
Yes.
A group. Okay. Yeah. Very good. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Put your feet up, relax, enjoy yourself. And we do have coffee up there to finish that pot up. It's been on all morning long. It's getting a little darker by the hour. So for anyone who wants coffee in the audience, too, help yourself. And make sure, see, my phone's ringing right now, but it's off. So make sure your phones are off so we don't hear it when it rings. Or you get to contribute to our coffee pot also, money pot. All right. Sorry about that.
Mr. Chair, no problem.
All right.
No problem at all. As I said, this is a department technical bill. I will speak to set the first four sections. I will walk through them briefly, and if there's questions, I'll be happy to answer them. In the first section, we're doing two things. We are changing the expiration date of the license, and we're also changing the fee penalty from $20 to 50% of the application fee. To that issue, to the 50% fee issue, in 2009 we had 20 pesticide dealers that were late on their fees. They paid a total of $400. The staff estimates that because of the change in how we're going to be collecting fees, that this year we will cut that. So at a $75 half of the application rate, at a $75 late fee with 10 dealers being late, we project that we'll be collecting $750. So a net increase of $350. So it's a very small amount. We're doing this to keep things uniform. We've been moving our late penalty is to half of the application fee, and this just makes it consistent.
Mr. Bezicki, why would someone not pay their fee on time and pay a penalty?
Mr. Chair, sometimes that happens. They overlook it. It's
exactly.
A relatively infrequent thing.
That's what I'm getting at. One of the irritants I have, I guess, and it's getting more irritating every year, is I'll get a call then from my fertilizer dealer who will say, you know, our bookkeeper was sick or they were on vacation. I didn't realize it was due. We sent it in on January 2nd, and now we got to impose this big penalty. You know, can't the department, won't they remind us, give us a phone call, send us a letter, why haven't you paid your fee, are you out of business, and then allow them 15 days or something to get it in so we're not incurring the penalties? Wouldn't that be a better way to go about it than just simply saying, boom, it's cut off, for whatever reason you didn't pay it and you owe us a penalty?
Mr. Chair, the deadline was, and I'll speak to the deadline in a few minutes, but the deadline was January 1st. We send out to all of our licensed applicators information in mid-November. We also alert them to various publications like our MDA update. There's training sessions, so there's actually a variety of reminders. We license approximately 500 dealers, and last year we had 20 of them that were late. So we actually think the dealers are pretty good about it.
Well, they are, and that's why I think, again, I'd like you to think through that with me and the committee before next week. And, you know, I'll take insurance, for example. They do the same thing. My insurance company for car insurance will send me out a bill, say your car insurance is due. And then I either pay it, or if I don't, they send out another letter the next week and say, well, unless we receive your fee, you know, you're going to be canceled in the next 2 weeks. And I go, oh my gosh, I didn't get that in, or what happened? But they give me the opportunity to pay before they just cancel me or fine me or do anything else, or you know, in their case, cancel. And I would think there's a much friendlier way to go about helping these folks out in these times, you know, and simply would be, you know, expires on January 1st, and, you know, if not paid by January 15th, you give them 2 weeks, send them a letter, you know, and on we go. But think about that, if you will. I'm not going to ask, put you on the spot right now to come up with language, but maybe the committee disagrees with me. But I, you know, I see it going on in commerce a lot because I'm a licensed real estate appraiser. And again, honest to goodness, if you're one credit short of your 30 credits you need, all of a sudden you've got this fine, and it's just bizarro land, you know, that people don't work more with these license holders and others around the state rather than just simply flat-out cutoffs and not even knowing the reason why. So think about that, if you will. Pet peeve of the chair.
Mr. Chair, we will think about that. We actually have some history, and I will assemble some of that history. And we will be prepared.
Don't spend a lot of time on it, but think about it.
Mr. Chair, if you request me to think about something, you can be sure that I will. In the Section 2, we're addressing a similar issue as in Section 1. Mr. Chair and committee members, last year, if you recall, we created a new agricultural pesticide dealer. This was largely to collect license individuals out of state or people who were not currently licensed. But we did miss something, and we're correcting it in Section 1 and Section 2. As in our previous discussion, January 1st was the application deadline. When we created this new fee system last year, the industry requested that the fees be paid at the end of January, not the beginning of January, but the end of January, so that they could tabulate up their pesticide use in the month of January and report it to us. The problem in this transition year that we have then is that we have a number of people who all of our dealers would, their license would end in January at the end of December, and then not start again until they've applied the application. So rather than hitting them with a whole bunch of late fees, we're asking for a technical amendment here to change it. So instead of it just lists at when the license expires, which is the end of January. So it's just a simple fix to the problem that we encountered, so we don't put everybody in non-compliance next year when we're collecting the fees from them. Section 3, we're making a simple change, which is changing the word private applicator to a person in B at the bottom of the page. And basically, very simply, what that does is it, in order to use and purchase a restricted use pesticide, you must have a restricted use, a private applicator for farmers, a private applicator card. For commercial, you must have a license card. So we are just clarifying here that it is the person who purchases and uses must have that card. The staff have encountered situations where a person being an applicator may believe that they are okay to purchase the product. And we want to just make it very clear that the person must be licensed or have that certification. And finally, in Section 4, we're doing another technical amendment here where we are correcting, we're adding agricultural pesticide dealer and pesticide dealer to those who must have a incident response plan. We're doing two things, but in fact, we have interpreted the previous language, a commercial commercial applicator, applicator of business to be that pesticide dealer. Last year we added agricultural pesticide dealer, so we're adding that in this revision. And we are also making it clear that an incident response plan is needed. The department has interpreted the existing language of having a plan that describes pesticide storage, handling, and disposal practices as including an incident response plan. We're just making it crystal clear that an incident response plan is required. We do not prescribe the details of that plan, and talking with our inspectors, most everybody, if not everybody, is in compliance with that. So this is clearly just simply technical. Mr. Chair, those are the four sections, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Jay, there's more of the bill. Who's taking over now?
Mr. Chair, my name is Quinn Cheney. I'm the Policy Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I will run through the rest of the sections of the bill. Section 5 deals with the department's food handler facility floor plan requirement. We usually charge a fee for that. We work with facilities so that they, when they're building a food facility, they locate bathrooms in the right places and sinks in the right places. We charge a fee for that plan, and we just are suggesting in this proposal that we would waive that fee for facilities that only sell prepackaged food, like video stores, that really where the, that's really not the primary purpose for the product. Section 6 deals with the bovine tuberculosis terminology. If you may recall, a few years ago we did a fairly massive buyout plan for herds located in the bovine tuberculosis areas, and the federal government has worked with us on that. We've got a lot of terminology in place that in our statute right now that mimics federal language, and the federal government is considering changing their program to move more towards this multiple zone area like we've had in Minnesota. In Minnesota, we have our northern part of the state has got one designation, whereas the southern part of the state, which didn't have any TB, has a different designation. So with the federal government moving to change their terminology, we want to just decouple our terminology from that federal terminology so that if they do change their terminology in the interim, we have no change in the way we are able to administer that
program. This
is Board
of Animal Health language, right? That's who the board refers to?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right.
That's also section 6 and section 7. Section 8 modifies the corporate farming and farmland ownership restrictions to allow for nonprofits to have an exemption.
What page are we on?
11.
Page 11?
11.
All right. Go ahead.
This section, as I said, would allow an exemption for nonprofit corporations that are actively farming less than 40 acres and who devote the profits from their farm to educational purposes, would allow them to be exempt from the corporate farmland requirements. And
just to that, and we're going to have more discussion on this as we put the bill together. I'm concerned about this language for this reason, members. We have some good corporate farm laws on our books now. We haven't been challenged in court like some of our surrounding states on it. You know, in Minnesota, you can only be owned by individual or limited liability, partnership, etc. And what happens now is if we give an exemption of 40 acres, and there's some asking for 160 acres, have asked me in my office to move it to that. I just came from the Ag Chairs meeting in Florida. We toured a farm in Florida that was owned by a nonprofit called the Mormon Church. And the Mormon Church owned hundreds of thousands of acres in Florida. So when you think about these nonprofits of being these small, you know, maybe a little co-op farm plot or something, it can be well beyond that. And at what point do we want to even bring attention to our corporate farm law or changes in it and open it up for someone to say, well, you exempted them now for 40 acres or 160 acres. What about me? You know, I own a grocery store. Why can't I have a farm out there to grow my own vegetables for my store? And why can't, you know, or large churches or large nonprofits? And so we're going to continue talking about that before we put the bill together. But I'm a little nervous about this one, quite frankly, from my aspect, and not wanting to do something. And I see the attorney from the apartments up here now, so he's going to weigh in too. But and that's great. Go ahead, Mr. Spanier, I believe it is.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Doug Spanier. I'm a lawyer at the Department of Agriculture. And where this came about, I'll just give a quick history. The last couple of years, I think with the rise of more locally grown and community supported agriculture, I've gotten a lot more calls from people wanting to do this and wanting to be a nonprofit and doing this. Currently, nonprofits can own agricultural land and use it for a non-farming purpose. They can own agricultural land and lease it to a qualifying entity, but they can't actually farm it themselves. And I was looking at joining a CSA and stumbled across the Women's Environmental Institute, who is actually farming land, and they are tech, so they realized they were violating the law. And we have another one up north who's called me that they're looking at for purchasing, and this is where I found out they actually have 155, I think, 50 of which is going towards the government SNAP program for donating 50 acres for low-income people to purchase their vegetables off of the cropland there. What I tried to do is come up with an exemption, carve out an exemption that was small, that would allow for the smaller community-owned nonprofits to do this without opening it up too much. So that's why I tried to say 40 acres, and then trying to say that the profits all had to go to educational purposes. You can say ag education if we want or something like that. I tried to carve it out for a simple exemption for some of these smaller entities that might want to do this.
Is there another structure these people could form to be under besides their 501c3 or whatever they're under? You know, again, we allow limited liability partnerships. Couldn't they organize these things in a different manner with an educational co-op attached to them? Or isn't there other structures they could use if they chose to?
Mr. Chair, committee members, you know, I'm not a tax guy, and I know, but I'm assuming some of the reasons why they do a nonprofit is that they can get some grants and they can get some money donated to them and doing some of that. And some of this stuff is not, I think, some of these people, they don't just do the farming. Of course, they have. I know this one that's up north. They're doing other parts too. They try to help the elderly. They want to do the farm to school program. They do want to do some of those other things. So I think being a nonprofit might give them a little, you know, more advantage for some of these other projects. As far as other entities, they could, if they had. An outside, you know, if they were trying to do it, if they're not family-owned, I think it would be very difficult for them to do anything other than possibly being an LLP. But I don't think they could do anything. Unless they're family-owned, I don't know what other thing they could do.
Right. Well, we'll keep thinking about it. I've expressed my concerns. Maybe it's okay, and we'll do that, but we'll look at it. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On a related question or topic, are nonprofits that own farmland or church organizations, like you mentioned, Mr. Chair, are they exempt from paying property taxes on that land?
So if the church owns it, like you said, and they don't farm it, they lease it out to a farmer next door who farms it, do they pay tax on that farm income that they realize?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I believe, I'm not a tax guy, but I think we had an assessor at the last hearing that discussed it, and I think some do, some don't.
Ms. Cheney?
Mr. Chair, someone with the assessor's office happened to be in the audience at the last hearing, and they said that for the most part that Yes, they do. There are some instances where they would not necessarily pay property taxes.
Okay. Any other questions to this? We'll keep thinking about it. Thank you. Forge ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's only one more section of this bill, a repealer, which eliminates a loan program for a native seed and wildflower loan program. The program has never been used, never been funded. We've not had any inquiries about it. We were just thinking of taking it off the books.
Okay. Any questions to that bill? The esteemed Representative Lilly is in the back row over here, too. So everyone wave at Representative Lilly. And who do you have with you today, Representative Lilly?
Gary Ellens, constituents and my nephew.
Okay, very good. Welcome. You're at the Ag Committee. Excitement abounds in here. All right, anything else, Representative Faust, your bill, this bill?
Yeah, two quick comments. One is I certainly understand the concern with the Section 8, which is why I really would, you know, like to keep the acreage as small as we can. I mean, we're trying to do something good for some organizations that I think are good things, and they're trying to do good things, but you always have to look at the bigger picture. Are we going to have a negative impact by doing this? And a second minor point is that we are raising a little bit of extra money here, so we don't have to take quite so much of those dedicated funds.
And again, my main concern for Mr. Sullivan and others going forward, I'm going to keep asking the question, does putting this into law, allowing someone new now to farm land, does that open it up in the future for someone else to come in and say, well, you just put an exemption in for someone who's never been able to farm land to farm land, so does a foreign ownership or a different corporate ownership structure come in utilizing this and say, ah, the door's open in Minnesota for a lawsuit on corporate farm, which is makes me nervous. That's the question. Not whether they should be able to do it or not. I understand these co-ops and other things, but I just want an opinion from research before next week on what they think the likelihood of opening that crack up, even just a hair, means to us. So, all right. Any other questions to that bill? Very good. We will lay that over for possible inclusion next week in a different bill. Representative Faust, I think you have the next bill, too.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 3021.
Okay.
And I believe that it needs to go to...
All right. It's going back to... It'll be referred then to Cultural and Outdoor Heritage Finance, I believe.
I believe that sounds right.
All right. Do we have any other referrals? That's the only one? Okay. He has an amendment? You got an amendment. You want to do that too, given the order?
Yeah, let's do the amendment right away. So I move amendment number...
He moves the 810
amendment. 2888 amendment.
Okay, and that's just, again, it changes general fund monies to clean water fund monies, which is where we're sending him now with this bill. So all those in favor of the 810 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That passes. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What this bill does is it sets up a grant program or rebate program, whichever you prefer to call it, for people that buy variable rate fertilizer equipment. A couple of reasons to do that is, number one, we can increase yields across the field without increasing fertilizer usage. We can decrease fertilizer runoff, fertilizer going into groundwater. And the second thing that there is, the other positive thing from this bill is that just about all of the equipment that does this is manufactured in Minnesota. So we can also hopefully stimulate some job growth in Minnesota. We've got a wonderful presentation here put together by Bill Bond, Craig Jorgensen, and Paul Trichka. So I'll turn it over to them and let them present this to you. And if you have any questions, holler along the way.
Very good. Proceed as you wish, but introduce yourself because we have a tape running, and then people on the tape later on, 100 years from now, knows who was talking.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Bill Bond, representing the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers, and we have two staff members with us who are going to present this PowerPoint for your information. We're very proud to talk about what Production Ag is doing to increase fertility and also decrease fertilizer pollution.
All right. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Paul Trichka. I am a certified professional agronomist, and I also work with CHS Inc. out of Inver Grove Heights. What we're doing here is we're speaking on behalf of this bill that Mr. Faust presented, 3021, which is what is production ag doing to help clean up groundwater? And we're looking, and my associate here, Craig, is going to be speaking a little bit later about the equipment being utilized, and there's just kind of a quick snapshot of some of the equipment that you probably see driving down the roads and in the fields during the summer and in the springtime. What we're looking at is different terms for a common practice: precision agriculture, variable rate technology, site specific. They're all very similar terms, and what they're basically saying is we're putting the right input in the right place in the right amount. And when you're talking crop production or production agriculture, there are 16 basic elements or nutrients that a crop requires, whether we're producing turf grass, corn, soybeans, sugar beets, or whatever. There are 16 nutrients, and some of them we have to supply. Some of them are supplied by the soil, some of them are supplied by the air. One of the things that we're looking at doing is also how do we efficiently use the energy, because a lot of the fertilizers we're utilizing are coming from energy, natural gas. How do we utilize these things and become more efficient with them? We're also looking at how do we decrease or reduce our ecological footprint. And by this I'm talking about is some work that was done by, in this next slide, we're looking at some work that was done by Dan Kaiser at the University of Minnesota. This was done in southern Minnesota. And as you can see on that slope there, he was experimenting with sulfur, with sulfur versus without sulfur. And what we're doing here is by applying the right nutrient, and this gives you just a quick visual on a slope there, we're looking at how the sulfur, the right nutrient in the right place at the right time, is giving us greater, we're not seeing the yellowing, the deficiency that's showing up, that's what that yellowing is. We're having higher crop production, which increases the organic matter content of the soil that we're produced, that we're being, which ties up carbon dioxide, part of that whole carbon sequestration process, because it's tying up the organic or the CO2 in the carbon or in the organic matter. We're also looking at how does production ag become part of the solution. And that's what we're doing here, and what my colleagues and I, what we're looking at, what we're doing, and we've been doing this for the past 20 years. We're also looking at, in the future, how does the things that we're doing impact our future generations? You know, we're looking at keeping that soil productive, so years from now, our ancestors, our future generations have good productive soil for future, to keep feeding a growing population. From an economic point of view, we're looking at improving the rural economy in Minnesota, and also through the creation of skilled jobs. And these are just a few examples of creating jobs when we're looking at the precision ag, as because these jobs are more specialized, they require more training, more education. There are basically four steps that we go through. Number one is gathering data. And this comes back from a scientific point of view. You got to have some place to start. We gather data. We go out there, basically do soil tests, determine what nutrients are there, at what levels, what are lacking, what's excess, and we determine where do we go from there. Just a quick snapshot. We're looking at a basic field. This is about a 200-acre field. We do lay over several different soil layers, things like a soil survey, which is the texture of the soil, coarse textured soils, fine textured soils, bring in sensitive features, things like streams, and then we bring in, you know, are there, do we need to create buffer zones or setbacks to prevent application near those areas. At that point, we then send somebody out there, and they actually pull a sample, a technician, they gather the soil tests up at each one of those locations. The data soil is sent into the lab for analysis. And then we also utilize other layers of information, things like a yield map. This is a yield map showing an area, part of a field,
And what we're doing is we're replacing the nutrients that have been removed by the crop. So we're just trying to keep a balance in that soil. We'll also look at the spatial variability of the nutrients across the field. Spatial variability is how the nutrients vary across the field. And we're going to look at one nutrient here, phosphorus, which always makes a very big concern as far as water quality. This is a soil test of a field that was taken in 2005. This is the phosphorus test. When you look at that map, the green areas are testing high. The yellow areas are medium, the orange areas are low, and red are very low. On the very right side of it, there's a building site there, and you can see that how the area is very high. That was where, if you remember back years ago when we were out hauling manure, that's where it all went. Dad says, take it, get it out as fast as possible. Well, that was what was done 50 years ago. We are testing very high in that area. From there, we turn around and we take that information and we create an application map. We sit down with the producer and we start making decisions on what needs to be done on these various factors. We create an application map, and then these nutrients are then applied. And the machines that Craig is going to be talking about here in a few minutes, we can apply 5-6 different nutrients all in one trip. So it's very efficient in application, from nitrogen or macronutrients, micronutrients, weed control, herbicides, things like that. This just continues with that same map. The right slide or right half of that picture shows the application of the phosphorus that went on that field. And just like on our lawns, they say if your soils are testing high in phosphorus, you do not want to use any phosphorus fertilizer. This particular map shows in that area where many years of manure application, it's the gray area shows that we're not going to be applying any phosphorus there. So we are looking at this as being an ecological advantage because we're not applying nutrients that are already testing high. To take a look at this is what has happened over time. Again, this is looking at the left side of the slide. That's the 2005 slide. And this last summer, that same field was resampled. You can see that same area just to the right of the building site, the phosphorus levels or the amount of green there has gone down. So our soil test levels have come down on that farm. So again, we're doing those things that we're talking about. We're using nutrients more efficiently. We're putting them where they belong. We're feeding the crop. And those areas that are testing high because of past applications, past knowledge, we're reducing the application there. Also, when we look at nitrogen, this is some of the things that we're looking at. We're also working with variable rate nitrogen applications. And my associate, Kevin Anderson, down at Wadawan Farm Service, we just picked four customers that we just had readily available, and we compared four fields that which are in the red bar as a flat rate typical application. This is what the grower would typically have done. And through these processes that we're doing, the use of layers, the credits, the nitrogen credits, we come in there with, and the green bar showed the amount of nitrogen that would have been applied to these that are going to be applied to these fields this spring, or as it shows there, it's a 15% reduction in the amount of nitrogen that's used or applied across the field without sacrificing yield. So we're becoming very efficient. We've had some challenges over the years. As I mentioned, I've been working on this since 1993, Precision Ag. We looked at things like hardware issues, computers and floaters, software issues, lack of economic data. That was some of the big problems back then. Education, again, these things are all, we're working on these things. The time it requires and the patience. For the growers, it does take them to be a little bit more patient because these things take a little bit of time. We also look at how variable rate technology improves quality of the grain. We see better protein content in wheat, improvements in sugar content in sugar beets that's grown in the Red River Valley. And lastly, we look at creating an as-applied map. So it becomes a documentation. Whether you're in, you're in some of the NRCS programs, the EQIP program, the CSP documentation of canning crops, because they want Here is, it creates an electronic copy of the time and date. It stamps when it was applied. So there's a, actually an electronic record. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Craig.
Welcome. Introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Craig Jorgensen. I'm with AGCO Corporation. As you can see on the slide here, there's actually two major manufacturers in the country for variable rate self-propelled equipment, and both of those companies have to happen to reside in the state of Minnesota, one of them being Case IH and the other one AGCO Corporation. There's one major spinner manufacturer as well that produces this type of equipment that's capable of three or more products variably applying, and that one is located in the state of Iowa. Right now, there's currently about 40 variable rate pieces of equipment sold in the state of Minnesota annually that can variably apply three or more products at the same time as they cross the field. Just to give you an idea of the cost of some of this equipment compared to non-variable rate equipment, if you look at the slide there, I have an illustration of non-variable rate equipment. The typical charge for variable rate equipment can be $60,000 to $90,000 over the price of a non-variable rate piece of equipment. So there is a pretty substantial upcharge to that technology. This is just an illustration of what the retailers are charging their customers for non-variable rate equipment versus variable rate equipment. And this is kind of the challenge that we're facing because there isn't a real large amount of difference between variable rate equipment and non-variable rate equipment that the farmer is willing to pay. And so with a $60,000 to $90,000 excess in charge, it makes it tough for them to want to accept that new technology, even though they see that it's better, because there isn't a lot of extra income that comes along with it. The other side of it, like Paul mentioned, is that now they have to have more technologized people on staff as well, and they have to go through more of a process to get to this point where they're making a map. So it's not as easy either to apply fertilizer as they have in the old days. Just a couple illustrations or pictures of the equipment from the two major manufacturers there. The one on the left would be from AGCO Corporation, the one on the right from Case IH. Just to go through a few of the pieces of equipment that can do this variable rate equipment, this is the spinner box from Highway Equipment in Iowa that can do three products simultaneously. It's called a multiplier bin. They have two main bins, which would be for the macronutrients, and then one micronutrient bin. And just to give you an illustration here, you can see how this points out. You've got a bin A and a bin B, which would be your macronutrients, and then they have a smaller bin in the back for micronutrient. They all get conveyed to the back separately. The controller controls each of those products individually as they're going across the field and reading the map. It then gets dropped onto the spinner here in the back, and they get spread out together in the field. But their rates are controlled individually as they cross the spots in the field for the spots that need more or less of those individual units, components. This is the Case IH FlexAir unit, again capable of two macronutrient products, one micronutrient product. And then AGCO units here, capable of, again, multiple units. And here you can see an actual picture on the top of one of the bins. You can see how it's split up. Two compartments for macronutrients, two separate compartments for micronutrients. All of those compartments are metered off separately, conveyed to the back, and spread out together. But they're metered off individually, so we can control the rates of each of those components individually as we cross the field. And then the last one, the most complex unit we have, is actually capable of four macronutrient products, two micronutrient products, and we can also do a liquid product at the same time with two herbicide products at the same time. So this one is capable of varying the rate of eight different products as we cross the field at one time. The whole thing comes down to the variable rate application equipment and technology improves our crop yields. It reduces the chance of water contamination by runoff. The illustration that Paul pointed out there with phosphorus where all the manure was put on, again, it's just a point that once phosphorus gets so heavy in the soil that the soil particles can't hold it anymore, that's when we see runoff into the groundwater because it runs off with the rain. If we contain the amount of phosphorus down, well, we can still maximize our yield, but we're not exceeding what the soil particles can hold, we're doing better for the environment as well. Potentially reducing the amount of fertilizer being used is another plus, as he pointed out with the nitrogen illustration. And then we're just helping the farmers to be better stewards of the soil with this type of technology. And as you can see from our illustrations, It's excellent technology, but the reason it's not growing at the rate we think it should is because it is more expensive, and right now the farmers aren't willing to pay as much as we think they should to get to this technology on their fields. That would be the end of our presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, again, I'll let you finish in a minute here, Representative Faust, but the reason it's here, members, is, again, I think all of us need to understand that the technology is coming, but also try and lay out that our farms and farmers are doing all we can for clean water too. And this is a good example, and I am anxious to have Representative Faust get over to Representative Murphy's committee and tell this same story, hopefully, so people start thinking we're not just spreading tons of excess fertilizer and other things out here that's washing off into our streams, but rather we're really trying to be a part of the whole clean water thing in Minnesota. I think this is a good example. But again, to put a couple $1 million towards this, how many units then would that incentive, Mr. Bond's people to go out and say, okay, I got a little reason for looking at this now, even a little closer, because there's an opportunity to get some help in purchasing this equipment. And in the long run, the more of these units we get out there, the better it is for our water and some of the other things we're doing. And Representative Szymanski is now wondering if he can do this for apples. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've got it figured out already. So my question would be for Representative Faust. The $2 million is a one-time appropriation, and is there money in the Clean Water Fund to do this?
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Szymanski. The way the bill is set up, it's a one-time thing, and it would be coming out of next year's money. So we're not going to go back and undo what they've already done for this year or the plans for this year. So the money would be next year. We would be taking the money out of the clean water money. And so that money, as far as I know, none of it is dedicated yet. And my feeling on it is we try it this year, see how it goes, and if it works well, we continue to put $2 million or however much we need to go on down the road.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One other aspect of this, and I fully support this trend, but in terms of the farmers going along and doing this, there's a cost of the grid sampling. I don't know if you're 2.5-acre grids or 5-acre grids, but we're looking at up to $10 per acre to have the sampling done, which in some cases does deter a farmer from doing this. So that's another area that maybe we could look at, that providing an incentive to farmers.
Representative Post.
I think that's a good idea, and it's a little bit harder to administer than this, unfortunately. But as we add more of these layers on, we can spread out that soil sampling further and further. And so, instead of doing it every other year, every third year, hopefully we can get into 5 or 6 or 7 years by when we put the discs in and have the yield results on top of the soil results on top of the on top of what we applied. Hopefully we can stretch that out so that $10, yeah, you pay it 1 year, but it's good for hopefully 5 or more years, so that it really boils down to a couple dollars an acre per year.
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. I'd like to respond to Mr. Szymanski's question about apples.
Yeah.
In the state of Washington, they are using the same technology on nut crops. So they do the same type of thing in the orchards and the groves. They go out there and they sample under each individual tree, and they have equipment similar, not these same machines, but they go out there and they do variable rate apply products specifically for each tree, what that needs.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And question probably, I don't know, some of the experts at the table there. Are other states advanced in variable rate technology already? And if so, are they supplementing the equipment costs in any way?
Is this a unique program or something you maybe see in other states or trending, or Mr. Bond?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Szymanski. It is an emerging technology throughout the Midwest. We have, I think, as much going on here as in any state, and certainly we produce the equipment here and in Iowa. So I would say it is moving forward. As far as the specific incentive, I'm not aware that it's going on in any other state, so this could be cutting edge.
Representative Hamilton.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to state that how much quality and goes into the AGCO equipment. It's phenomenal.
Whose district is that in?
Phenomenal.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I've been through the facility, and if any of you would like to tour it, we could probably set that up, could we not?
We sure could.
Yeah.
Actually, Falk isn't here. I think the IH is in his district, so we're not going to have that war today.
That's too bad.
I've been through the plant, too, and I can testify to that.
I think that would be a great spot for an ag committee tour.
Yeah, and we should. As we get out around the state like we try and do every year, that'll be maybe one of our stops, yours or IH's place, and get a firsthand look at what you're doing. So, any other questions or comments to the bill? All right. You did a good job. Members, Representative Faust renews his motion that House File 3021, as amended, be re-referred to the committee on... Cultural and Outdoor Heritage Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Your bill passes, Representative Faust. Members, that's it for today. There's no meeting tomorrow, and we'll be working on bills for next week. I believe it's Ag Day at the Capitol, so if you get down there at noon, you'll see a bunch of farm types down on the rotunda. With that, we are adjourned.